for me, it is a theme of the return of energy security. That had really disappeared as a theme during COVID because prices went down, demand went down. It came back with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I think it's really back on the table, and that it reinforces in a way, ties into your larger theme of neo-mercantilism, because it points to resilience in supply chains, to the degree possible, greater independence from the system, diversification, and all of those are benefits, but they all come with a cost.
I'm Jake Davidson, Deputy Editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. For today's podcast, we're sharing highlights from a recent conversation between the head of our portfolio strategist group, Adil Lele, our head of commodities research, Ian Singer, and Dan Juergen, one of the world's leading energy experts. And for those who don't already know Dan, he is the vice chair at S&P Global, the author of several books, including The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power, which won the Pulitzer Prize, and The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. And he is also the leader of CERAWeek, the world's premier energy conference. And I'm joined by Adil now. Adil, why don't you introduce this conversation?
Look, for a couple of years now, we've been discussing in our global outlook internally and with our clients, two major secular dynamics that are unfolding. Firstly, modern mercantilism, and secondly, artificial intelligence. Now, point in time, at the center of these two dynamics is the energy market. Now, in some ways, that's pretty remarkable that this one sector, energy, is still dominating how the world will unfold. But in other ways, it's not that surprising because it's been at the center of how the world's been shaped over the last 150 plus years, as Dan's written about in his books. The big thing that we've been wrestling with here at Bridgewater is how we prepare for the wide range of outcomes associated with mercantilism and AI. Now, against this backdrop, we've of course got the Iran war. And so in this discussion with Dan and Ian, we're really going to get into these dynamics, the impact on energy markets, and how we really could see a reshaping of the global economic landscape.
Yeah, it's a great discussion. And it's basically in two parts. The full discussion was very long. So we've cut it down to a series of highlights. And those highlights cover how the Iran war is reshaping the global energy landscape and how AI may potentially be shaped by energy as well. So let's get right into each of these clips, starting with Dan and Adil discussing how the energy shock from the Iran war, which Dan calls the mother of all supply shocks, is reshaping the global energy landscape.
Well, obviously, the Middle East has been central baseload for world energy. And I think we don't know how this ends, but how people will see the balance of energy and reliability, I think it does give stimulus to new pipeline development from the Gulf, because the key countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE are not going to want to be as dependent on the Gulf as they on the Strait of Hormuz as they have been. Secondly, we've already seen, and it was interesting at our CERAWeek conference this year, I really heard it in March, a new emphasis on exploration for oil development around the world. A sense that U.S. shale, while it still may grow, it is going to plateau. It is a mature resource. And suddenly companies that had been less interested in exploration, that maybe it even allowed those skills to atrophy somewhat, are stepping them up. And so I think we're going to certainly see more activity, more exploration in the Western Hemisphere, which, by the way, even before this crisis, was producing more oil than the Middle East. We've seen that change in Canada, where you have a government, also a Liberal Party, but under Mark Carney, not under Justin Trudeau, that's pro-energy, supporting energy development. And I think that out of this, there's going to be a more general focus on energy security. I think it means a revival of coal in parts of Asia, which had been switching to gas. I was very struck by the comments from Prime Minister Modi of India. I mean, I was in India more than a decade ago when he really started to push LPG cylinders into the villages to people to use it for cooking instead of using wood and waste for cooking. And in the last few days, he's called for frugality, a return to natural resources, because India has been very hard hit by this because it depends so much on those LPG cylinders for cooking and very dependent on the Middle East. So I think in general, this will be a drive for governments who have the capability for diversification of supplies for the future. And I think the other thing to say is resilience, and obviously building new pipelines in the Middle East, new ways of getting oil out of the Gulf without going through the Strait of Hormuz will be part of those resilience strategies.
I mean, this all sounds very capital intensive. With everything we're talking about now, seems like it's really just going to be exacerbating the higher cost of capital environment that's born out of, firstly, a lot of fiscal spending that's taking place globally for mercantilism more broadly, pushing towards self-sufficiency, and also, of course, the huge amount of artificial intelligence capex. So this seems to be just another big draw on capital that we're going to see across the world when we're talking about all of these, you know, greenfield and brownfield expansions. And
if you go back to your neo-mercantilism, it is more inflationary because, of course, now that second age of globalization, which we kind of all grew up with, which is now more or less over, at least in the form that it had taken, maybe we could call it easy globalization, was just based upon efficiency, driving down costs. Now, once you decide security, resilience, self-sufficiency are important, all of those tools following your formulation mean increased costs and increased spending, and translated, I think, in your work, into a more inflationary environment.
In this next clip, Dan Adelanian go a level deeper and discuss what the post-Iran war energy landscape may look like for Venezuela, Russia, China, OPEC, and Europe.
Well, let me take Venezuela first. I think we can't quite call it a change of government in Venezuela. Much of the government's the same, the change of the leader, and that there were kind of three forms of response. There was a kind of independence, the entrepreneurs, the Latin American companies that said, we can do something quickly. Then secondly, there were the larger companies who said, well, there are certain things we can do. They'll take a couple of years, like connecting gas fields that are in Trinidad and Venezuela, operating them jointly. And then there's the big bucks, the big investment. And that, you know, companies were reluctant because of their experience. But I think that a result of this, what's happened in the Gulf, that will mean that Venezuela rises up in terms of, people will be more interested in going back sooner than they would have otherwise been the case. For Russia, except for the fact that the Ukrainians are so good with their drones and their missiles, trying to disrupt their supply, this is good news for Russia because it increases the price that it's earning for its oil and that funds its war. China, it's very striking because, of course, China is highly dependent upon the Gulf. It imports 75% of its oil. About half of it comes through the Strait of Hormuz. And interestingly, while one focuses on the amount of oil it gets from Iran, it gets more than three times that amount of oil from the Arab producers. So the Arab producers are very important to China as well.
Yeah, sort of going through some of the list on powers, OPEC has had a change in constituency that is interesting, with the UAE deciding now is the time to branch out on its own. And aside from the OPEC desire to invest in different forms of energy and different regions, I think they also want to expand their capacity and move, capitalize on their resource in a time frame that is likely sooner than later, especially if you compare that to the outlook for Chinese demand or global demand with the accelerating EV penetration, which I don't think is just a China story. I think eventually that'll be a global story as well. So I think the OPEC countries are aware of that longer term demand shift. And so they want to get their barrels out faster. They want to get to the resource that they haven't gotten to, and simultaneously want to be investing into higher value products further up the value chain, moving into gas, moving into derivatives of gas and higher value oil products is all part of that. And they've been doing that for years.
Ian, that's a very good point, because I think if on February 27th, somebody had said to, well-informed people, the Strait of Hormuz is going to be closed. It's, it can't happen. But if it happens, what would be the impact? And people would have thought about oil. Some people would have thought about LNG and natural gas, but people wouldn't have thought about fertilizer, aluminum, petrochemicals, helium. And by the way, also that region's a very important exporter of something else called money in the form of sovereign wealth funds. And I think what this has also brought to the fore is just how quickly those countries in that region, not on the Iranian side, but the Arab side, have become integral into the world economy beyond what they were 20 years ago, and much more important overall in the world economy. And so what's happening here is not just an energy story, but it's a larger global economic story?
It's a broad economic story. It extends beyond energy to trade more broadly, and very importantly, to capital flows as well. Just a few days ago, we wrote a daily observation looking at the impact of capital flows from the GCC to the rest of the world. And to your point, previously, these economies had been large exporters of capital. And we say that on the margin, at the very least, right now, some of that's going to start to be directed internally for defense and other purposes as well.
By the way, if I could say, we're talking about the GCC. We also got to look at Europe's problems here, because Europe is, we know that the area that's been hit the most, the hardest, is Asia, because 80% of the oil coming out of the Gulf went to Asia, 90% of the gas. But Europe has been particularly hit in terms of jet fuel because it was so dependent upon it. And I think this comes at a time when Europe was really having to go through a rethinking of what its priorities are, because it had been, it's kind of energy investment. So much had been on climate and regulation. Before this happened, it had to worry about competitiveness and increasing defense spending. And now it has to worry even more about resilience in terms of energy. So I think this is, if you're talking about the unfolding challenges of this, Europe faces some very big challenges as well.
And do you think that results in a, let's call it, deprioritization or maybe reprioritization of the push towards renewables in Europe and more towards energy security? Or do you think those things actually go hand in hand, where their path to energy security is through increased use of renewables?
Well, I think we're going to see a rebranding of renewables, less in terms of climate and emissions and more in terms of energy security. So I think that's already happening. But I think Europe also needs to extract itself, if it can, from its regulatory straitjacket. I mean, as you talk to leaders of European companies and they're in a disinvestment mode to get away from this very heavy-handed regulation that seems to be insulated from market realities.
With the caveat that the jet fuel element is difficult to replace with a renewable investment. Mobility at large is difficult to change unless you have an upstream source or a refining sector that can produce that. And to Dan's points, the regulations are what have caused closures of refiners and disinvestment in industrial capacity and upstream companies to stop investing in Europe upstream production and even across into the UK.
Next, Dan and Ian discuss what past energy shocks like the 1970s can tell us about what the future energy landscape may look like.
Well, I think in the past, of course, when you've had those crises, you end up with a surplus at the end of the day. And we'll see whether that is the result or whether this is different, but that there becomes a renewed emphasis on resilience. So much of the energy security measures that we see today that are in operation were a response to the crises of the 70s. And once again, we're reminded of the fundamental importance. And I'll tell you, if there's one huge impetus in Washington these days, it's to reduce, as they say, to diversify supply chains on minerals, which means reduce dependence upon China, both as a source, but mainly as a processor of minerals. And that gets to your neo-mercantilism theme so strongly. It just turns out it's hard to do that. It takes investment and it drives up costs to do that.
Yeah. And I think if you look across the energy landscape and into the critical materials, minerals landscape, there's a connection where investment in the capacity to have control over those things in a domestic way, however you want to put your perspective on domestic, on a long time frame are good economic investments. But it's capital intensive, but the ROI on those in a modern mercantilist world are good. And at the same time, because they're good, if the capital can get formulated, it likely does lead to a longer term view of deflation on the prices for those things as you start to replicate the supply chains globally.
In this next clip, you'll hear Ian share how he's processing the Iran war supply shock as an investor and the key dynamics he's watching from here.
Yeah, the focal point is still the geopolitics, just because that's going to determine how the disruption manifests in actual flows in the near and medium and long term. Thus far through this period, inventories have been a critical lever to try to offset some of the disruption. As we move forward, that lever doesn't exist in the same way as you deplete those inventories. And coming into this event, The refined product inventories globally were much more constrained than crude oil inventories. And even within that, inventories broadly in Asia, ex-China, were lower than other parts of the world. And as we've moved through the last few months, those inventories have gotten increasingly stressed, and the impacts of pricing, particularly in Asia and particularly on certain refined products, diesel and jet, namely, have created some demand destruction. And the picture for those inventories in Asia, ex-China particularly, that runway is not super long, you know, order of magnitude of a few months before more critical pieces of the economy will be incrementally challenged. And that puts a lot of, again, a lot of focus back on to the what happens in the Strait and the politics. And so watching the politics, watching the inventories, how they move, and triangulating, you know, how that transmits into price and demand destruction are the things that I'm really watching.
In this next clip, the conversation shifts to artificial intelligence and how energy supply will be a key determinant of how the AI build-out plays out. Let's listen.
At the same time that we're seeing this major dynamic, modern mercantilism that's very clearly underway, we're also seeing the rise of artificial intelligence. And we've been following this story for a while, actually, since back in 2012, Bridgewater's been deeply connected with the artificial intelligence landscape. And in terms of the impact on economies and markets, it was back in 2024 when we wrote that in our daily observations that this was a bet on science and how the bubble was ahead of us. And then in 2025, we discussed the resource grab phase due to the existential business need that a lot of tech companies saw in AI. And now we're seeing massive amounts of CapEx for data centers. And this dynamic is something that's only increased over the past few months as we've taken another large step forward in terms of adoption that's driving a greater need for inference components and really solidifying this resource grab phase and this dynamic of demand exceeding supply when it comes to data centers and the inputs. And so all of this demand, and indeed the supply, also creates this huge need for reliable sources of power and energy. I recall being at CERAWeek in 2025, Dan, and what was so interesting to me was that it was more like a technology conference within an energy conference. And so I'd be interested in your perspective as someone who founded and has led CERAWeek for decades now, how you're seeing that dynamic play out between tech and energy.
Well, this year we had the presidents of both Google and Microsoft there and a big delegation from NVIDIA, so it would have looked even more like an energy tech conference. I think this year it was really tech hyperscalers meet energy was the kind of theme, aside from the war in the Persian Gulf there. But the question of electricity, it is a hugely pressing question about electricity. And China does not have that same pressure on its electric supply system as the United States does. And so, as I think the CEO of one of the big tech companies said, electricity is the main constraint on AI. And there you need a lot of building to do that. And I think that was kind of what we saw as really a lot of the discussion at CERAWeek this year is about, well, how does this actually get done?
I mean, I think it's interesting. There's obviously consternation on the U.S. grid and the capacity and the ability to keep up with the capacity for the power demand. Behind-the-meter solutions have, I think, proven to be more expansive, and developers of data centers have been more willing to rely on those than I think people have given credit for. You know, we wrote an observations late last year where we explored the amount of power the grid could provide to data centers, but the wedge of that demand that could be satisfied behind the meter. And even against our own estimates, the capacity for behind the meter solutions is likely emerging to be higher than what we had forecasted, which bridges some of that gap, not all of it versus the unconstrained, you know, upside of demand, but certainly a large part. And some of that has been fuel cells. Some of it has been not high-end turbines like you would typically see for the large-scale gas power plants, engines that, you know, they might use to power frac spreads, you know, are being repurposed to go and become behind-the-meter power solutions. Battery deployment has ramped up and probably exceeded the expectations for what type of holistic solutions can get designed behind the meter to serve data centers. And then I also think as we move along, I think there's going to be a trade-off between locating data centers in regions that were typically viewed as necessary for serving low latency inference to now having, you know, more use cases where the data centers can be located in areas where there might be some excess power supply in the middle of the country. And so I think that likely leads to more capacity than would have otherwise been appreciated in the U.S. And I think all of those vectors will get exhausted in the next few years as the U.S. races to build out the capacity that they want. And so I don't necessarily see it being a constraint per se versus making some economic and, you know, maybe some latency choices to ultimately serve the demand that is there.
Well, certainly the demand will be there. I think that's a very interesting point you make, because you have seen, you know, lower, not big turbines, but companies that make smaller equipment suddenly finding that they have a future, particularly, as you say, with behind the meter off-grid solutions. Our numbers, which I don't know how it matches up with you guys, is that, you know, right now data centers are probably around 5% of U.S. electricity demand, within 5 years being around 14%. I know others have higher numbers, like 17%, but it is a very rapid growth as this race is on.
As Dan and Ian just shared, energy capabilities are one of the key pressures on the AI buildout. But another pressure is the political debate around how energy is used. And this has become increasingly controversial as AI data centers have expanded. Here's how Dan and Ian are processing that debate and the implications for AI regulation.
Well, of course, the U.S. is a federal system. So you have the federal government, and then you have the states, and you have state regulatory commissions to set rates and so forth. And it's at that level where you see the opposition. You know, whether rates have gone up because of data centers that may or may not yet have been built, or they've gone up for other reasons, that really plays into the affordability question. And it's something that's going to hear, I think, a lot about that going into November, at least in the United States. I think in many ways, regulation, you know, there's efforts to streamline regulation on federal land so that things don't take so long to get approved, or things that would not have been approved under the Biden administration getting approved. A very good example is in Alaska, where the Biden administration had not allowed a road to be built to a major mineral mining resource, but it's got to go ahead under the Trump administration. So that's happening. But I think that this increasingly pervasive anxiety about jobs and AI combined with data center, it has become not, it's not a national movement, but it can be very strong in regions. And I think that the hyperscalers have become hyper-conscious of it. And that's partly about the beyond the, behind the grid things that, that Ian was talking about, was also to respond to the political pressures as well as the need, actual need for electricity.
Yeah, I think the combination of grassroots popular opinion of the build out and local regulation is as important as any of the enablements that the federal government wants to try to do. There are plenty of cases now of, you know, even inside of the state, like very local, denying data center permits, putting moratoriums on assessing new data centers, rescinding error permits for data centers that that are applying, putting restrictions on running data centers that violate air, you know, air permit and air quality standards or noise pollution. And in some ways, this actually reminds me a little bit of what fracking, the fracking discussion was, you know, sort of in the last 10 years, where there have been places where, you know, the local regulations have made it very difficult for operators to exist. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the development stops nationally. It just changes where and what the cost is. But the political popular opinion will be really important. And it seems like it will probably end up on the ballot in some form or fashion as we approach the midterms.
Next, you'll hear Dan, Adel, and Ian connect the dynamics they've discussed to the broader modern mercantilist trends that are driving a push for energy self-sufficiency around the world. Let's listen.
I think for me, it is a theme of the return of energy security. That had really disappeared as a theme during COVID because prices went down, demand went down. It came back with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And I think it's really back on the table, and that it reinforces, in a way, ties into your larger theme of neo-mercantilism, because it points to resilience in supply chains, to the degree possible, greater independence from the system, diversification. And all of those are benefits, but they all come with a cost. And so I carry away from this conversation that a neo-mercantilist world is not a world of greater efficiency, but it's a world of greater costs as well as friction and unintended consequences.
The thought that kind of spurred for me too is that, you know, if you look back to 2022, the political alliances looked much more like what the political alliances had been prior to that conflict, by and large. And right now, those political alliances broadly feel a little bit more strained or with tensions. You know, the US and Europe not quite as solid as, you know, I would have described that relationship in 2022. And so a mercantilist map where people are having to, you know, invest in the resilience and security for their own area, like that can add tension that may not have existed in a different way. And so even if the energy map is changing the picture going forward, the political map may have to respond to that as well, and not in necessarily a way you might expect.
I would go a little farther in saying that the fissures are greater, actually, that the kind of the world of alliances that was born really after World War II are under a lot of strain. Otto, I would think, you know, you as a keen observer of markets know that you mainly notice confidence when it's not there. And I think in terms of alliance relationships, it's the same. You really notice trust only when it's not there. And I see a growing deficit of trust. And I think that makes it a more dangerous and uncertain world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we certainly, you spoke about the costs of the world that we're in. Even if we just look at the energy sector, the costs seem very clear, which is an inflationary dynamic, which is a cost that everyone bears, a higher cost of capital that's needed to attract capital in to go and fund the greenfield expansions, the brownfield expansions that we talked about for energy security. I think the erosion of trust brings a higher risk premium on assets more generally as well, by virtue, if nothing else, of reduced cross-border capital flows. And then finally, what's clear out of this discussion is you can try and alleviate one choke point in the global energy supply chain, and you can even try and alleviate it through looking for alternative sources of energy, but you just create other choke points elsewhere. You know, if we move away from oil and hydrocarbons and we move towards solar, that creates another choke point. When you move towards renewables, and that can create another choke point from a regulatory standpoint as well. And so the global energy market just seems to be a rolling set of choke points that we're rolling through. So that's kind of the ultimate cost.
Yeah, if you think about it, not all that many years ago, people talked about the borderless world and people, goods, services all flowed. And, you know, it was very easy. You know, any of our listeners here who are not from the U.S. could easily come to the U.S. and students and everything. And so we've gone from the borderless world to a world of choke points. And mm-hmm. as you're suggesting, Atul, we will discover new choke points that people hadn't really focused on until it's staring you in the face.
Yeah, I mean, it was only a couple of years ago when we were talking about Russia invading Ukraine. And back then it was, actually, you haven't seen too much of a sustained rise in oil prices or in energy prices more generally, because there's just plenty of sources of energy around the world and everyone's pretty diversified right now, and energy will find a way to flow. And here we are, you know, 2-3 years later, where clearly that's not the case.
Yeah. I mean, then it was a question. We went from a global oil market to a more partitioned oil market, but you had the same amount of supplies more or less flowing around. And you had the rise of shale in the U.S. and LNG elsewhere, but very significantly U.S. shale, that to Putin's surprise, LNG could, when he tried to use the gas weapon against Europe, mm-hmm. failed because of LNG. Mm-hmm. But now this is of a whole different category. This isn't a question of redirecting flows yeah. and shifting flows. It's absolute shortfall.
Dan, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us and our daily observation listeners as well. We always just get so much out of these discussions, and even in this discussion was no different. So thank you again for all of your time.
Well, it's great being on with you and Ian, and I think we all pushed each other's thinking. So thank you for the opportunity.